Truman Capote was a New York City author who pioneered what he called the nonfiction novel, taking real people and their stories and putting them on the page with all the tension and intrigue and great dialogue of literature. He wrote In Cold Blood about a murder that took place in Kansas, and that book made him famous. Now, of course, telling true stories with real people as characters, that's something lots of writers do, or at least try to. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we'll be hearing about the nonfiction novels of 2018. That is later in the show. First, a play about Truman Capote being performed in a local bookstore. Will Leatham, who runs Prospero's, is with us now. Hi, Will.
Good morning, Gina.
So we'll introduce the actor playing Truman Capote in a second, but first, what interests you about Truman Capote as a literary figure?
His use of language, of course. Whimsy, a little bit of bite, a certain rapscallionness to him.
What is that?
He's an ornery man, and he loves to have a good time, in particularly this time of year. I mean, with the play this time of year, it's about Christmas, and this is not always the happiest time of year for most people, or for a lot of people, and some of us work through that in different ways.
And that's what this play is about.
That is exactly what this play is about.
Well, when you think about the Truman Capote you see in this play, how does that compare with the Truman Capote you've sort of held close to your heart as a literary person?
When I came to Capote, like many people, through In Cold Blood, and of course through watching Breakfast at Tiffany's and reading, you know, Songs for Chameleons.
He wrote that too.
Yes, he did, and just a ton of great short fiction. I'm a short fiction reader, and I like his short fiction.
Tell me about his short fiction.
Again, I mean, the pith, he modernized Hemingway in some respects. There's just a precision of language use. And again, it's modern New York Hemingway.
You're alluding to, I feel like, a certain playful viciousness, but viciousness,
yeah,
maybe nonetheless.
Yes. I mean, it's New York City, and he was a part of the socialite circles and all of the intrigue and continuing to fight for top drawer and top billing in those sort of situations. So,
and if people have seen Truman Capote played by an actor before, it's likely to have been Philip Seymour Hoffman in the movie Capote.
That's correct. And this came out of a play I saw. And I, right after I discovered or came across In Cold Blood, I saw the PBS production or presentation of this play.
True.
And then about a year and a half after that, it came to Kansas City. And I can't remember. I was trying to think back where it was, the Midland or the Folly or one of the great playhouses in town. And it's just, Capote is such a captivating character. And he brings so much pathos and maybe a little bathos to the situation. So,
well, let's talk to the actor who is playing Truman Capote. He's here with us, Philip Blue Owl Hooser. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I understand about this play that it was written at the request of Truman Capote's estate, and that the playwright was at first reluctant because she found Capote kind of off-putting, but then she discovered something in her research about how he was in the final years of his life, and that changed her perspective. She said he had a gallantry in the face of a devastating situation. Can you explain what she means?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the devastating situation was his having published a single chapter from his book Answered Prayers, which he'd been working on for some 15, 20 years at that point. But it did expose, basically, the social circle that he ran in with Gloria Vanderbilt and Bill and Babe Paley and the Whitneys and Lady Nancy Keith, all of these really important people, but who were just awful about each other and had these terrible attitudes. Well, once that got published, they basically turned their backs on him. He even wasn't invited to the party of the year, which was Swifty Lazar's, his agent, Swifty Lazar's annual Christmas party.
And he was kind of known as a bon vivant of a kind. Like he would entertain people with stories about who he was interviewing or his personal life. And he knew kind of how to play a crowd.
And
with a cigarette and a cocktail in hand.
One of the lines in the play, in fact, is where he says that he would tuck these socialites into bed, these very important women. And he said, and then I'd tell them a bedtime story. And they always loved hearing something horrendous about someone impeccable.
Yeah, I mean, the voice that you are doing is pretty much exactly the voice Philip Seymour Hoffman did. And then if you go back and find old video footage of Truman Capote, it's spot on. He had a distinctive voice that kind of almost asked for him to be made into a character on some level.
Oh, absolutely. And then as far as the finding the character of Truman Capote attractive, too, eventually that J. Preston Allen, the playwright, did, I think that there's a quality to him that people want to comfort because he is in an awful situation. And I've even had an audience member who said to me, I just wanted to run up on stage and hug you. And I was like, oh, that's so wonderful. She wanted to comfort Truman.
Because he's alone.
Yes.
And what is he doing? Like, so this is a one-man show. And you're basically Truman Capote, talking to himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Explain.
Talking to himself. He also talks to some people on the phone. But then, as it says, he just turns to the audience and starts talking to them. And he asks various questions of them, actually, as it goes on. You know, you may not be the kind of people who talk to yourselves out loud. Or have you ever thought about killing someone? Or what thoughts would go through your head if you were drowning? He's full of questions because he's interested in people. And that interest in people comes throughout the play as well.
So the audience becomes like the circle of socialites who have left him in a way.
Well, or people that he thinks would be sympathetic who just happen to be somehow sitting in his UN Plaza apartment on Christmas Eve.
Can you pick, I know this is a big ask, but can you pick a moment from the play to do for us as Truman Capote for our listeners? Like a moment ideally that does not rely too heavily on body language.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's all a lot of storytelling. But I think one of my favorites is when he talks about, he's just gotten off the phone with his friend Carol. And he asks, you know, you're probably wondering who that was. It's Carol Mathau. Oh, she's a dear friend of mine. Carol and Gloria Vanderbilt and Una Chaplin O'Neill used to be very close pals, and they all ended up marrying these dirty old men. Carol's second husband is Walter Mathau, and they live in California. I mean, actually live there. I think that it's a known scientific fact that for every year you live in California, they take 2 points off your IQ. And yet, as redundant as I find it to die in L.A., I know that a lot of old people are very comfortable there. They hear the breeze coming through the winter flowers, and it says to them, sleep. Or they hear the voice coming off of the ocean, and it says, sleep. Well, I'm not ready to take that big sleep yet.
As redundant as I find it to die in L.A. So dramatic.
Oh, so many observations, just little pith. He's a big glass of orange juice with vodka and extra pith.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, that voice, though, that we've talked about, how did you go about working on that? That must have taken a lot of practice, or did it come pretty easily?
Well, it came to me actually as a child. You know, there used to be people who would do impersonations, and they became, you know, famous, Rich Little being one of the greats. And I started picking up on the idea of doing impersonations as well, because there were so many people that had such distinctive voices and mannerisms, and Truman Capote was one of them, and I've just done it for years. And then I've also gotten to be Alfred Hitchcock, playing not only a role on stage, but hosting a concert as him.
That, what just happened to your face and, and like shoulders up when you did that is incredible, because I don't mean to be rude, but you grew a chin when you were a child. You did.
Well, it's part of it is physical, and doing the physicality helps create the voice. So I've just done impersonations all my life.
So back to this play, True, about Truman Capote. You guys, Philip and Will, you see this as a holiday play of a kind. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes.
What aspect of the holiday season does it get at?
Seasonal affective disorder, I think. As Truman explains in the play, he doesn't have a very good relationship with Christmas. He's somewhat ambivalent about it, and we find out more about his own relationship with Christmas later in his life and later in the play. But it does take place on the 23rd and 24th of December as well, and that's making things worse for him, because he says he wants Christmas to be a magical time with friends and family gathered around, and it just doesn't happen sometimes.
Will, chime in here.
Well, it's, again, we all have lives that we project that we want to live, and, you know, you juggle, you keep balls in the air, and if they don't fall on the ground, you're juggling no matter what it looks like. But we have these lives we want to have, and quite often Christmas puts kind of an exclamation point on the reminder that maybe there's a little disjunct between what we want ourselves to be and where we are. And a lot of people find that hard to get through, and I think this play is cathartic on top of being enjoyable and insightful, but the catharsis of realizing you are not the only person out there who, at this time of year, we're thinking about things. So,
what's special about seeing this play in a bookstore? I mean, it comes from Broadway. It was not a play made for a bookstore, even though it might sound like it is.
Well, I mean, you're in Truman Capote's home, which is his apartment in New York City, and he is a bookish man, and it's full of books. And I mean, there's an intimacy to also being in a bookstore, or in, at least in Prospero's, it's a small room. So you are really on the set, as it were, and you're in his home. And frankly,
it feels homey.
It feels very homey. You're right there. You are in this man's life for a second.
I always feel at home when I'm surrounded by books, so yes.
So, Will, I mean, this is maybe particularly for you, but the tension in this play, or the situation Truman Capote is confronting, it's something that I think all artists face, but especially probably nonfiction writers. You write about real people, and that comes with real life consequences, because you're putting this version of real life that exists in your head, you're making that public. And not everyone likes the image in the mirror you're holding up, or not everyone agrees with the image in the mirror you're holding up.
We must all live with that to some degree. Plus, we also process and grow. I mean, anytime you look and see something you don't want, there's more than one response to that. It's not I surrender. It can be I'm going to change, or it can be maybe somebody else is misperceiving me and I shouldn't be listening to them project what it is they're seeing onto me.
And Capote was very honest about himself as well. As he said, he says in the play that I've said things about myself that would make a baboon blush blue. And he was very honest about himself as well as other people. And he just expected that to carry over.
You know, Will, as a bookstore guy, can you talk just briefly about the thread connecting Truman Capote and the nonfiction being published today?
And it's that's a great question. I approach nonfiction, not in books so much, but as episodic pieces, be podcasts or blogs or newspaper articles, not so much newspaper, but online articles and journal articles.
That is how a lot of people consume nonfiction today.
And we treat, I mean, well, nonfiction is, it's so real. So we quite often want it in a little bit more bite-sized components. I mean, the world is too much with us, as the poet would say sometimes. So, and again, I think, you know, we have this problem we're having right now. You have Edmund Morris and his interjecting of himself into his biography of Ronald Reagan. You have a million little pieces. The line between, you know, even having people, again, I'm going to say Hemingway, I don't mean to be off on him, but, you know, they published a posthumous memoir of his called A Movable Feast. I mean, what is true in some respects and what isn't? I mean,
what is true and what isn't is a very good question. Well, Will Leatham, Philip Blue Alhuser, thank you both so much for being here.
Oh, thank you, Jewel.
Philip plays Truman Capote in the production of True at Prospero's Books through December 30th. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. After the break, our bibliophiles will join us. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're looking back on this year in literature with the bibliophiles, specifically nonfiction. A lot of critics are saying it's been an exceptional year in the genre, and it's certainly been a big year for a handful of local nonfiction writers. So let's find out what's worth reading from this huge stack of books and, as we just heard, also podcasts and long-form journalism that you have to choose from. You can join this conversation with your recommendations for nonfiction of 2018 at 816-235-2888. The bibliophiles are Katie Stover of the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Gina.
Mark Luce with us from the Barstow School. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning.
And freelance writer Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Hi, Jeff.
Good to be here, Gina.
Alrighty. So, Katie, before we launch into recommendations, as a library person, what are your insights into what readers are gravitating toward in the nonfiction section? And then maybe some theories as to why.
Well, I just recently saw several lists of top five nonfiction checkouts from the area libraries. And of all the lists are showing one or two of the three big Trump books that were big this year. Higher Loyalty by Comey, Fire and Fury, and what that tells me is that people are interested in reading about what's going on in the world right now, and they're looking to those books, which are all fairly critical of Trump, and I don't think that's got anything to do with it. I think people are mostly interested in trying to understand in book form what is going on. And they're getting inundated by news stories from lots of different sources. And so they're
bite-sized pieces.
Yeah.
And they're hard to catch up if you're behind.
Exactly. And so they're turning towards these books that they hope take a longer view.
Well, so I saw, you know, KCUR's Laura Spencer has reached out to a lot of libraries, and she's putting together some of these lists. And what I thought was interesting is that every list had a smattering, and it's from several local libraries, a smattering of politics, specifically really focused on Trump and insider sort of stories about the Trump administration, like you were saying, but also true crime and self-help. But I would give a caveat on the self-help and say self-help with attitude. Like, there is a book that made most of these lists with a title that I can't say on the air, but it's a four-letter word
starting with F,
and it promises a counterintuitive approach to living a good life.
Oh, gosh, I wish I knew what that word was.
That's the one by Marc Maron, right? Right. Those of you familiar with Marc Maron know what we're talking about. And this self-help always makes the list, but self-help with attitude now is probably trending because they're looking towards a younger audience that wants their humor, wants their advice in bite-sized, maybe snarky pieces, and wants to just cut right through the nonsense and get down to what is it you need to do to fix your life. And most of the self-help books that I'm seeing, and I don't really like to use the term self-help, more like self-inspiring.
Life improvement,
life hacking. What people are really interested in are the books that are teaching you and demanding you turn off your technology and be more mindful. Maybe focus on meditation. One of my favorites this year was Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, because I am a fidgety skeptic. And books on just turning off the devices and getting back in touch with your family, with your friends, with nature, with your community. There's no surprise in that one of the trends in nonfiction now is hygge, the Scandinavian notion of happiness.
Oh, right.
And the library last night just threw an event on hygge, how to do it for the holidays. And that's...
Is happiness easier to achieve when it's a Scandinavian kind of happiness?
I think the Scandinavians have figured out how to enjoy happiness on an everyday smaller scale. And that's what these other books are reminding us, to stop and appreciate the smaller things in life. Everything doesn't have to be chaotic and dramatic and deadline driven.
So people are diving into the drama of politics and then out of it with Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics.
But with a dose of true crime.
It seems to me
that those three things go together rather perfectly.
Oh, they do.
I want to hear that.
Yes, tell us.
Well, the reason that, I mean, the Trump thing is you haven't had that big of personality in the office. And
well put.
All of those books, what?
Well put.
And all of those books are like, hey, let me tell you this thing that you don't know about. And so the first one that the guy,
Comey and Michael Wolff are the
I'm
two.
Thinking of the Wolff and the Woodward book. Like those are like total insider, like inside baseball, like, hey, let's look and see all this. And then sort of, and that's different from the drip, drip, drip or faucet of daily news. So then you're sort of freaked out by sort of what happens. And so you go to like, well, I'm already sort of, these are scintillating. So let me turn to true crime and read these horrific sort of things that happen. And then like, okay, I'm freaked out now. I'm going to be, I'm going to go be Scandinavian, not so much happy, but unsad.
All right.
Well, doesn't hygge like involve cocooning and snuggling?
Those are activities. It involves candles. It involves warm sweaters. And really, it's a focus on appreciating the simpler things in life. Warmth, coziness, those are the emotions you're after, but you achieve that with through food, through connecting with your friends, through building your community, and just making your world a little bit smaller, a little more, not, I guess, controllable is not the word, but a little more contained and a little less chaotic. It does involve snuggling. It involves dogs and cats, if you like that, warm blankets, candles, stew.
Books, though, you guys. Katie, before we get into the lists of recommendations everyone's brought, you mentioned just now that one of your favorites of the year, and something I think didn't quite make your list, Meditation for a Fidgety Skeptic. Can you give a quick review?
Very quick. I'm such a fidgety skeptic that I only got about two or three pages in that book. But not two or three chapters, but the first two chapters are the money chapters. And essentially, I read this book because I'm trying to figure out how to meditate. And even the author takes on that snarky tone of voice. He's like, I know, you can't do it. He's like, nobody can sit still for 2 hours. We just don't live in that sort of society. And so he's encouraging people to teach yourselves to sit still for anywhere from 60 seconds to 5 minutes and increase it a little bit day by day. And I gotta tell you, sitting still for 2 minutes is a long time. I'm not a toddler, but I can't sit still for 2 minutes. It's not as easy as you think. And to completely empty your mind when we are bombarded with so many messages. But it takes practice. Mindfulness takes practice.
So what are you reading? 816-235-2888 is the number to call to share a nonfiction book that came out in 2018 that left a real impression on you. 816-235-2888. And so let's start with recommendations. Hitting none of the trends we just discussed, I am pretty sure, is the inside story of The Wire.
Actually, it would hit all of those trends except for the self-help.
Okay.
Because it certainly would do politics. So The Wire is a television show that came out in 2002 on HBO. And it traces Baltimore. And each season it focuses on a different thing. The first season's the drug trade. The second season's the docks. The third season is the mayor's office. The fourth season is schools. And the fifth season is the newspaper. It never got good ratings. It got okay
really?
Rate. No, never really. They struggled each year to get renewed.
That's crazy because I feel like everyone was obsessed with it.
Everyone was obsessed with it after it was done. It really wasn't until the fourth sort of or fifth season. And so this book, The Inside Story of The Wire by Jonathan Abrams, basically is an oral history of the show from basically conception with David Simon and Ed Burns through kind of the last episodes. And one of the things that I liked about it so much, I love that show and I think it's pretty much the best show that's ever been on television because it does so many things. It's a Dickens novel in somewhere where you normally wouldn't expect it.
A boldly positive review of The Wire.
Yeah, I feel fairly confident in that. I don't think that's a really going out on a limb. But the thing that's so great here is that with an oral history, you get firsthand testimony. And so all the books that I brought today are all firsthand testimony. And so you get not only the actors, but the characters that they play. You get the tension in the writer's room. You get the HBO executives who are saying, maybe we're not going to renew this. And two of the best people that they interview are a character who played a guy who played Bubbles, who was a sort of a junkie, but also a police informer. And his name, the actor's name, is Andre Rayo. And then most people's favorite character, Omar, who's played by Michael K. Williams.
Yeah, and Bubbles was sort of a tragic character in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, in many ways, they all are.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the great things about the show is that it's not just good guys and bad guys. Those lines continually blur. And another thing that was really cool about the book was a woman, Uta Bracefitz, was the director of photography, the cinematographer for it. And the stuff that she adds to the oral history is absolutely fascinating. She really has a sense of the city, and sometimes would even lean into to David Simon, the creator, or to Ed Burns, the co-creator, and kind of say, hey, maybe we should do this. And so learning that kind of stuff is pretty cool. If you like The Wire at all, this is pretty much something that you have to have.
Okay, and so then taking a sharp turn away from the inside story of The Wire, that was not an intended pun, but it turns out it's going to work like one. There's this, one of the titles Jeff has brought in is Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion.
Yes, this is a book that I reviewed for the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion by Michelle Dean. Michelle Dean is a magazine journalist and a book critic, and a lot of the richness of the book comes from the witticisms and smartness and intelligence of the writers that are included. Just on the front, we have Dorothy Parker, Renata Adler, Joan Didion, Nora Ephron, Susan Sontag, Hannah Arendt. And the thing that kind of snagged me a little bit on this book was that she felt like she had to strive really hard to establish these writers as being in the center of the intellectual life of the 20th century. And as a person who cut her intellectual teeth reading these women between book covers and magazine covers, I didn't think she needed to do that. Some of these women were friends, like Mary McCarthy and Hannah Arendt, and some of them were enemies. Renata Adler did a real famous savage takedown of Pauline Kael in the New York Review of Books. Most of them did not consider themselves to be feminist, although they opened doors for women writers who followed them. And it's really just smart, accessible scholarship. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Speaking of getting snagged on it, I've only heard the title. Something I'm a little snagged on is the word opinion, just because opinionated is such a loaded word when you're talking about women that I'm curious whether that's directly addressed, this word opinion, and who
Absolutely.
Has one and who...
Yeah. I mean, given when these women started writing, oftentimes they were the only female name in the interior pages or on the masthead or on the cover, and they were criticized for being sharp. And that, sorry to say, exists still today, but especially then. Dorothy Parker started writing her tart observations before women got the right to vote. Susan Sontag was criticized by one female reviewer in the Washington Post as it shouldn't be right for somebody to be that good looking and that smart. So obviously we've progressed since then. But
sort of a backhanded compliment.
Yeah. I mean, for somebody, and also I think for an introduction, to these women writers, it was very valuable. I liked it a lot. This woman herself, Michelle Dean, is a pretty sharp writer, and she won the 2016 National Book Critics Circle Award for Excellence in Reviewing.
Well, I want to stick with writing about women and sort of giving women we've known for a long time, another look. Katie, talk to me about Meg, Joe, Beth, Amy, the story of the Little Women and why it still matters.
Oh, by Anne Boyd Rieu. She came to the library in August for the publication of this book. And this book came out to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the publication of Little Women. And coincidentally, it jived with PBS's Great American Read that ran all summer long. And Little Women was one of the books you could vote for. But this book is what I think of as a trend in publishing. It's a biography of a novel, and it's
much like a biography of a television show.
Yes, or a person. And what Anne Boyd Rieu does is look back at the influence these four characters have had on our pop culture today, why they still resonate, and they do still resonate. If you are a fan of Buffy or Felicity or Rory Gilmore or Angela Chase or even the Golden Girls, Sex and the City, or HBO's The Girls, they all had their start in Little Women. The character of Joe has influenced those characters immensely. And the four distinct personalities of the sisters are what gave rise to those quartet female TV shows.
Tell me those four personalities.
Well, there's the homemaker, homebody of Meg, the oldest, which is not unexpected considering she's the one that's closest to their mother. Then there's Firebrand Joe, who is very different, her father's daughter, whip smart. There's Beth, who's a little reticent. We all know what happens to Beth. Unless you live in Great Britain, you did not know what happened to Beth if you read Little Women as a child. Beth is the quiet, introverted character. And then there's Amy, the real standout, the real different child. Amy, the character who gets a bad rap for being selfish, for being self-centered and smart and goal-driven. Amy was actually my favorite character while I was reading these books. I thought Joe was okay, but I thought Joe needed to, you know, quit being selfish in her temper as well. And I liked Amy because Amy was goal-driven and knew what she wanted and was willing to go get it and did not want to be wronged. And I thought, okay, this person is matching Joe spirit for spirit, but since you can only have one heroine in those conflicts, got to be Joe. That's the character everybody goes for. But I'm Team Amy.
Jeff, I could tell you wanted to say something.
I'm definitely Team Joe. I'm a Joe girl. I sort of feel like the Beatles, you know, you were a Paul girl or whatever. I'm a Joe girl all the way.
Yeah. Why?
Yeah, I was George.
Spooky. She was a writer. She read a chapter to her sisters and said, guess who wrote that? Me. But I mean, that's interesting, looking at Amy as sympathetic, like attitude, right?
Well, everyone thinks that Amy is so self-centered. And there's Joe. Guess who wrote this? Me. That's pretty self-centered, I should think, and a similar in character to Amy.
Maybe anyone reading a book is likely to sympathize with a proud writer in a different way.
Want to hear something funny about Louisa May Alcott? She tried like heck to kill off these characters. This was the blockbuster of its time, Little Women, and it was published in two sections. So if you read it in England, you didn't know at the end of Little Women, where there's a wedding, that Beth dies. You knew that in America because in the United States, they published both sections of that book as one book, but not in England. So that's a real surprise to British readers. But Louisa May Alcott didn't want to keep writing about these characters. She wanted to go back to her thunder and blood potboilers.
You know, okay, so we've heard about two books that really have a very particular take on gender being your favorites. And then I actually put out a query to staff at KCUR about their favorite nonfiction of 2018. And books exploring women's lives, women's relationships, and gender are top of a lot of people's lists. We have Caroline Campbell recommending Text Me When You Get Home, The Evolution and Triumph of Modern Female Friendship. And I have never heard of that book, actually, but she says that she loved reading about how crucial female friendship is for women today and how it has always been, and how the idea of friendship evolves and grows and changes in society. So many of the friendships discussed in the book reminded her of her own friendships and the female spaces they create for themselves. Anyone read that one or heard anything about it?
I read a review of it, and it was a very positive review.
We also have Melody Rowell, the producer of this show, saying, "I'm not joking. Bachelor Nation was one of my favorite books of the year." She explains that Amy Kaufman, the author, is an entertainment writer at the LA Times, and that this is contextualizing the book in the world of our current social issues, the world of reality television. And then she concludes her review saying, "It's neither condescending nor celebratory. It recognizes that the show is, quote, hella problematic, but still so fun, and that you can be a fan, a feminist, and a critic all at once." Do you think that just a lot of these books are us as a society trying to reconcile womanhood, trying to reconcile gender issues, trying to reconcile what it means to be a feminist, all of these questions?
Yes. Yes to all. The answer is yes. It's time. Publishers are recognizing that what readers want to read about, and they are publishing the books that are reflecting the conversations we're having with each other. They're giving voice to women.
You can join this conversation at 816-235-2888, the great nonfiction you have read this year. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, here with the Bibliophiles. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I'm here with the Bibliophiles, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, and Katie Stover. Hi again, everyone.
Hello, Gina.
We are talking about our critics' favorite nonfiction reads of 2018, and we were just talking about gender, but I am also interested in a couple of local books that have made some of our critics' lists this time around. Katie, tell me about No Place Like Home by KCUR's own CJ Janovee.
And that's not why I brought this book.
I've never doubted that this was a legit recommendation.
This book really is one of the best books I've read this year. And CJ might be tired of hearing me talk about this book. And I just used it in my ReadVent and LibFaves list this year on Twitter and Instagram of books. This is from a small press, KU Press, and it deserves a much larger audience than it's getting. It's a social history of LGBT activism in Kansas, of all places. And it is surprising, it's moving, it is frustrating and inspiring. It is a far richer history than we expected as we read the stories of these people who had no idea that they were laying the groundwork for a movement and making history. And CJ captures
They were people navigating the world.
They were.
As themselves.
As themselves, and they were fighting the good fight, and they were actually teaching younger activists how to be activists.
And when you say we're not talking about like long ago history. We are talking about like year 2000-ish, mm-hmm. up into like 2006, 2008.
Yes.
This is recent history.
This is recent history. But it still reaches back. And CJ has traveled all over Kansas to talk to these people. And they are so real. This is a book for Kansas history buffs. This is something that you should... This is a book that you should have in your hip pocket if you're going to talk about Kansas social history. So this was a marvelous book. It is engaging and lively. I loved the pacing. I really loved getting to know all of these different characters.
It's also such a reminder that headlines just scratch the surface of what's going on.
Yes. Learned so much more about what was going on in Kansas and how hard these people worked and sometimes how they had to walk away from the fight because the fight was about to destroy them.
You know, we interviewed CJ when that book came out. You can dig up that interview at kcur.org/centralstandard, but also read the book, No Place Like Home. Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, you are recommending Heartland, a memoir of working hard and being broke in the richest country on earth by Sarah Smarsh.
You know, that is a mouthful of a subtitle for sure.
Sure is.
Just a disclaimer. I know Sarah, she was a colleague of my husband's at Washburn, and I know she's a friend of yours, Gina. And this is going to sound condescending, and I don't mean it to be. I've loved Sarah's work since she's left Washburn. The whole time I was reading this, I kept saying, this is amazingly good. This is surprisingly good. And I didn't mean that as a put down, but just the originality of it. Unlike Barbara Ehrenreich, whose work I like as well, who wrote Nickel and Dime sort of from the margins of the working poor, then returning to the middle class, or J.D. Vance in Hillbilly Elegy, who was a product of the working poor, and who basically said, you know, if these people didn't have cell phones, you know, they could pay their grocery bills just like I do. Sarah is a product of the working poor and proud of it. And she was the product of a teen mom. Her grandma became her grandma when she was 30. Sarah lived in 21 structures by the time she graduated high school, which was an improvement over her mother, who lived 48 places before she even started high school. She ended up living with her grandma, who was very warm. Before that, she lived...
Jeff, I'm going to jump in here because...
Oh, sure.
We interviewed Sarah on the show, and we are going to be re-airing that as part of our Best of 2018 next week.
Okay, I'm going to stop her up. Yeah. I'll just say that I had...
So find out more on that, but
one
what
issue.
You liked about it.
What I liked about it is that it is wonderfully incisive and original, and Sarah is proud and not condescending and very candid as well. The one thing that hung me up about this book was the conceit she uses in which she addresses her unborn daughter and the daughter she says she'll never have, which is really basically just an interior monologue she started having with herself. But you're reading along and the narrative is really gripping and really involving, or the analysis is very rich. And then all of a sudden she addresses you. And for me, that tripped me up. But it deserves all the accolades it's getting. It was a finalist for the National Book Award. It's on many people's best book list. And she knows how to write.
When she came to the Kansas City Public Library, there was a really giant crowd there. And people asked her unbelievably challenging questions like, what causes poverty? You know, like, it was a pretty amazing thing to see her tackle answers to those questions. But the thing that amazed me most at that event was how important it seemed to be to her to reiterate that she loves Kansas and that this was also meant to be a celebration of the place she's from, even though there's so much focus on the challenges of her upbringing.
Absolutely. I think many, many people are reading this book who are not normally reading books. And I went to her reading at Liberty Hall, and it was packed, absolutely packed. And people stood in line who had grown up in similar circumstances who really wanted her to sign their book. She's really tapped into something. She's hit a sweet spot, if you could say that about poverty.
So Sarah Smarsh's Heartland. Mark Luce, talk to me about Jeff Tweedy's memoir that's on your list.
Jeff Tweedy is the lead singer of a band called Wilco. He had been in several other bands before. So he wrote, basically he ran into some problems with addiction 4 or 5 years ago. And so this memoir is part of, I don't want to say the recovery, but it's part of that. The first band that you may have heard of that he was in was Uncle Tupelo. And he was in that band with Jay Farrar, and they had a famous sort of breakup. And then Tweedy went on to form Wilco, which has now become like dad rock. And
maybe
a demographic.
Young
a demographic.
Dad rock? Kind of,
no. Yeah.
No, we're
it's
not young anymore.
Yeah,
okay, sorry,
it's a demographic
forgot.
I am now in. And the thing that's nice here is that he's a wonderful songwriter. And he's trying to find his way in this memoir. It's like you can tell that he's not totally comfortable with the form. And it feels almost more like you're sitting down with him. And
but wait, can I say something? Jeff Tweedy, I would say, like, part of his whole deal is not being comfortable with his form. Like, I saw him perform solo with the guitar. He didn't look at all comfortable with what he was doing. Isn't that, like, kind of his deal?
Is maybe
being
solo
a little uncomfortable?
Well, I think I don't know. I don't know that I would... I think he doesn't necessarily like attention, a ton of attention, but he's also like Wilco's not like he's not a rock star. He's like a mid-list, like dudes who are of my age know him and have known him for a long time. And so to me, it's like I know him more through his music than I do from his stage presence. And so from his music, he doesn't seem uncomfortable at all. I mean, he writes about difficult things. But the thing that I like here is that you're sitting next to him and he's telling you a story, and he's telling it the way that you would tell a story. So there's digressions, there's surprises, there's laughters, there's quick U-turns, there's pain. And it comes along, he did his first ever solo record that came out basically at the same time as his book. So that's kind of fun. I enjoyed it. I like him, but I particularly enjoyed this. I think it's if you like that band, this is again, it's like one of those you kind of have to read it. But he's a wonderful American songwriter.
And you also have with you Stephen Hawking, Brief Answers to the Big Questions.
Yeah. I thought that the Brief Answers to the Big Questions would be written so that a literary guy could kind of understand these big science questions. That's not necessarily. It's brief, sometimes confusing answers to big questions. And so a lot of those answers, like here are some of the questions. Is there a God? How did it all start? Will we survive on Earth? Will AI outsmart us? And the answers, a lot of the answers are no. Like, just no. Like, we're not gonna make it, right? But the thing actually that surprised me about it was the tone. There was a almost like a giddy up in the prose, and kind of a sweetness and an almost impish sense of humor in it.
So now, there was some delight in the writing itself.
There was, but then there's this very weird thing at the beginning that says this book is taken from, like, some of it's written, some of it's taken from interviews, and then his colleagues have kind of filled in the blanks. And so there's just this little part of me
that wonders if this is a hologram.
That's a very polite way to put it. and so while I really enjoy it, there's a part of me that's like, well, wait a minute, because there's a Brexit joke in it. That just, it sounds like the joke was written like 3 months ago and not what would have been 2 years ago.
When Stephen Hawking was alive.
Yeah, it just, I don't know. But the thing, if we don't, basically here's the gist of it. If we don't go to space, we're all going to die. That's pretty much, like that's the book.
Well, you just made most news irrelevant.
Our robot overlords will better us. There's that too. So maybe the robot overlords will send us to space.
Okay, well, this seems like a fitting transition to the title of a Lori Moore book being recommended by Jeff. See What Can Be Done.
You know, this book was just an utter treat. Lori Moore is mostly known for her fiction, which I admit I have not read.
Really?
But as a book reviewer, See What Can Be Done, Essays, Criticism, and Commentary, she is an absolutely brilliant critic and brilliant writer. And the title derives from when she started reviewing, the editor of the New York Review of Books would send her prospective books to review and say, see what can be done with this. And she, boy, can she do things. I went on the plane yesterday, came back from New York. I was just reading her appreciation of Stephen Sills. I mean, she can write about anything. And in her introduction, she lays down some basic rules for reviewing, really encourages the use of the first person. I am liberated as a book reviewer. First person, here we come. And she just knows her way around metaphor. And now I really want to read her fiction, which, of course, everyone else at the table, I'm quite sure, has already read her fiction. I did not also realize that she has an endowed chair at Vanderbilt, as well as all the other things. I got this book because I was in an Albuquerque bookstore and said I would love to have it, but I couldn't afford it. And the bookseller, who was the book owner, said, I'll give it to you for half price. Try it.
There is a
I like that.
My favorite Lori Moore moment is, and I won't say where it is, something bad happens to a character that she wasn't expecting at the end of a page. And when you turn the page, the whole next two pages are just ha 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 for two pages straight. And I mean, yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, we have so many more books to recommend, but we don't have time. So it's time to say goodbye. Our time is up. The bibliophiles are Jeffrey Angowdy, a freelance writer and book critic. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for inviting me.
Katie Stover with us from the Kansas City Public Library. Thank you.
Always a delight.
I hope you get less fidgety.
No.
And Mark Luce, who teaches English at Barstow School and writing at KU. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure.
And their recommendations will be listed along with the audio from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. It'll all be there later today. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, have you thought about a social media fast or dropping out of the whole thing altogether? A KU researcher has studied what we actually do with the time we gain when we unplug. Tune in for that discussion tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by KCUR's Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. KCUR's Up to Date is coming up next, so don't go away.